Hi, welcome to this Physicians Weekly's podcast. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm your host for this podcast. And today we've got some great interviews as usual.
This is Physicians Weekly.
Hey everyone, today we're covering episode 106. This week we have two guests catching up with us the newest and greatest news in their respective fields. We're going to start off with the startling fact that almost half of adolescents have experienced a mental health disorder such as depression or anxiety. And while medications have their potential to be very effective for most individuals, others might not respond or even worse, experience adverse reactions as a result of their genetics. And when it comes to treating children and teens in crisis, we know that every single second counts. And drug gene testing can help doctors ensure that they're prescribing the right therapies from the very start. Genetic tests for variants impacting drug metabolism have advanced tremendously, and insights uncovered in youth can yield lifelong benefits by identifying which treatments will be effective for each patient. So, to that end, we speak with Dr. Joel Diamond. He's a practicing family physician in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and he's going to unpack how drug gene testing can optimize behavioral health treatment pathways for young patients for their entire lives. Our next speaker, we talk with Dr. Jennifer Brown from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute at Harvard University. And she's going to talk about what every doctor should know about recognizing the symptoms of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, and what some of the recent developments are in treating that difficult disease. She also talks about how she's organizing the International Workshop on CLL, or the IWCLL, and she's organizing it this year in Boston. And IWCLL is an international nonprofit association which is committed to creating progress regarding the management and outcome of CLL patients worldwide. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Diamond. Can you just start off by telling me who you are, what your position is, and what your interests are in your professional life?
Yeah. Hi, Rachel, and thanks for having me today. I'm Joel Diamond. I am a family physician. I've been practicing family medicine for, and it pains me to say this, up to 35 years already. I've been involved in some medical technology as part of that time, which I've mixed with my practice, continue to see patients and continued around in the hospital. Now, I'm currently also the chief medical officer for a medical technology company that's looking at how we can bring genetic information to the point of care better for physicians within their electronic medical record.
All right. Thank you so much. So your specific interest is in young adults and adolescents. Is that correct?
Well, as a family doctor, my specific interest is the lifetime of patients. I think my interest in pharmacogenomics in particular and behavioral health tends to focus on that group more, mostly because of the incredible crisis we're having now.
So can you tell me a little bit about the science of the genetics and the behavioral health medications that are being used to treat adolescents and psychological disorders?
Sure. First off, on psychiatric medicines in general, we're seeing such a large increase in the use of those medications, not just in adolescents, but also in adults. And there's many reasons why that may be. So certainly the incidence of psychiatric disorders, particularly in the adolescent group, has increased. I won't go into the reasons why that may be. And of course, we still have the same option here of recommending that people get therapy or take medication, but it's still, we're a medication-oriented society. So the trick is here is which medicines help people the best and which people benefit from those medications. And we have desperate parents and we have inadequate medications and response to medications. And we're in the middle of a crisis of adolescent psychiatric disease right now. So those of us who see these patients, we know that when we give people medications, the right people medications, the benefit from them is tremendous. We also know that there's a huge placebo effect in some people. And we also know that many of these medications are ineffective and some of them are not tolerated well. And in this population in particular, inability to treat these patients is particularly tragic. And I don't mean that adults have more time to figure it out, but I do think that there's a desperation and a time factor here in getting adolescent patients to the right treatment and very quickly.
Exactly.
The second part you asked about pharmacogenetics and the influence of that. We've learned over the years that most of us, in fact, maybe up to 99% of the population, in fact, has some genetic variant that affects drug metabolism. Now, that sounds like every single person on the planet is going to have trouble metabolizing a drug. And thank God, most of us don't take a lot of medicines. And when we do, it's not the medicine that may be affected by that particular gene variant. However, in the subset of patients that have behavioral health issues, that becomes incredibly important. And it may, in fact, reflect the fact that 50% of patients who take drugs for major depression end up not responding to those medications on the first drug. It may be the fact that 30% of patients that take psychiatric medicine end up stopping those medications, either because they're ineffective or they have side effects. And that's really where I think the role of pharmacogenetics plays a big role.
Yeah, very interesting and important to keep in mind. So what should doctors and parents know about mental health medications in their children and young adults?
Yeah, I think the key here is to make sure that you get involved with somebody who can make a correct diagnosis for the start. Today, there are so many overlapping diagnoses with mood disorders, with drug and alcohol issues, with attention deficit disorder, with other personality disorders, etc. And I think it's important to first establish a correct diagnosis. The other piece of this is to make sure that we're not just, quote unquote, throwing drugs at people to try to make them better. It has to be part of a comprehensive program. The other side of that is that these drugs, for the most part, are incredibly safe and very, very effective. Most of the SSRI drugs have been around for decades, and their safety profile is in some ways unprecedented. And that is part of the problem, I think. Because they're so well tolerated for the most part, there's often a knee-jerk piece for physicians to say, well, why don't we just try them first off here? So the key, I think, is to find that correct balance. The hard part, as you know, is finding the right drug that can treat people early on. And this trial by error method of prescribing psychiatric drugs is really something that I wish would stop very, very quickly.
Right. And as I recall, some of the SSRIs actually do have adverse events associated with people under the age of 24, correct?
They do. And the package insert, as you know, in particularly in this age group, is an increased risk in suicidal behavior. And that's certainly concerning with that. Why and how and which subpopulations are most affected by that continues to be a subject of research right now. So careful use of these medications, selecting the right population, but it underscores the need to get people on the correct medicine the first time.
And can genomic studies actually and testing support these decisions at this time?
They do. So when we look at antidepressant treatment or anti-anxiety treatment, I'll look at SRIs in general. What happens? Patients come in to see me, their family doctor, they're given a medication. Why that medication is chosen over another one is for many, many reasons. It's usually physician preference. And then we tell patients to wait 4 to 8 weeks to see if there's a therapeutic response. And if there isn't, then we increase the dose and we ask them to wait another 4 to 6 weeks and see if there's a response to that and so on. And if not, then we change medications. Or if there's a side effect, we change medications. If you think about the time from the symptom onset to the time they may actually see their doctor to the time they reach a therapeutic level of the correct drug, it could be months, upwards of a year. And as I said earlier, I don't think we have that kind of time anymore. This is a crisis, and there's a sense of urgency to this. What pharmacogenetics can do is, instead of picking a drug out of a hat, and I often use the expression, at least give me a smaller hat to pick from.
That's good.
So if I know which drugs they're not going to respond to, or if I know which drugs are more likely for them to have side effects from, let me avoid those. There's plenty of SNRIs on the market. Let me at least do that. So I think one of the questions is, where in the treatment paradigm do we introduce pharmacogenetics? After the second failure or the third failure?
Right. Or a priori completely, yeah, if possible.
That, I think, is the real question. For me, in my adolescent population now, I'm really starting to think more about, as you said, a priori, because of the crisis nature of this and the time frame of this. So there aren't any standards of care for introducing pharmacogenetics pieces here, but I think those of us who are using this in our practice know how dramatic it could be. I'm glad to share some anecdotes where I think it's real helpful, if I could do that, Rachel.
Yes, please.
So not that long ago, a family that I've been taking care of a long time, the parents have a daughter that I actually had never seen in practice. She was seen by her pediatrician most of her life, went off to college, and her mother told me that she had been suffering from depression on and off through adolescence, which became much worse through college, and she was really, really struggling. And one of the problems I'll say is this is a very, very bright young woman, and she was performing well in college. In fact, she applied to law school and she was accepted at several top-ranked law schools. And one of the problems was many people say, well, if you have depression, how are you doing so well in school? The reality is she had been treated with multiple medications, which either had side effects or didn't work. And her parents were concerned that maybe she had treatment-resistant depression. And the young woman herself wanted to postpone going to law school and seek treatment with ketamine, knowing that that would have some effect on her ability to concentrate and lots of other things. And somewhat in desperation, her parents asked if I would see her. We did a pharmacogenetic test before I even saw her, and the results are somewhat unsurprising but staggering, which is the last medication she was on, she was a rapid metabolizer of that drug, meaning she never ever achieved therapeutic level. The drug before that was a drug that she was a slow metabolizer of, and in fact would take a very long time for her to reach therapeutic level, in which case she didn't. She quit it because it, quote unquote, wasn't working. And the drug before that was one that she metabolized poorly and she reported side effects from it. So here this young lady comes in, and I said, let's try this alternative medication, which you metabolized well. And lo and behold, 4 weeks later, it's a miracle. And she's off to law school, and she's doing well. Now, I know that's an N of one, but those types of stories are incredibly gratifying as a physician. And again, in hindsight, you look back and say, why wouldn't we have introduced this kind of test early on? We do it in everything else in medicine. We use all the means possible to select the right antibiotics. We use cultures and we use sensitivities to get the right antibiotic to people. And in some ways, I think this is analogous.
Right. And so is this a suite of genes that are being tested in a panel situation, or are these Mendelian factors? Would, for example, could you expect if her parents also need or her children later need treatment that you could expect similar effects based on a Mendelian 50-50%?
Yeah, good question. So oftentimes they are. And the first question you asked was, is it a panel of genes? And it is. The gene variants that affect behavioral health medications is actually a narrow one. But today, we generally do a large panel. And truth be told, if we're doing a pharmacogenetics panel, we might as well do the entire panel for all drugs that we know about today. And there's a reason for that. One is there's new evidence every day that some variants that we recognize may have more of an effect or less of an effect than we thought. So as science progresses, as new drugs hit the market, we know their effect by these genes. So doing a test once, the phrase test once and query often, really, really comes to mind in this. And the other piece of this, of course, is that large panel doesn't affect just behavioral health medications. It includes pain medicines, cardiovascular drugs, anti-seizure drugs, medications for gastrointestinal disorders, on and on and on. And so really it's a test that's going to affect people's total health and the ability to query this through in their entire lifetime.
And just a pragmatic question, are these tests covered by insurance? Are they something that you can prescribe?
Yeah, so that's the interesting thing. Medicare, and that doesn't really affect this population, in fact, recognizes the value of these tests and is often covered. Some insurers are paying for this test, and where they are in particular is generally in the behavioral health field, which is reassuring. But the coverage of this is still too little and too late, in my opinion. But there is a bit of a myth that the cost of this test is exorbitantly expensive. And it isn't.
Not anymore.
Yeah. So like a lot of things, and you think you can get your watered down, and I don't mean to disparage it, 23andMe ancestry test for $100 or so, you know, for the same range of price, why wouldn't you do something with this incredible value, even as an out-of-pocket cost? So I think we're approaching the cost of the test, what most people's deductible is for any other diagnostic test that they may have. So it becomes affordable whether insurance is the issue or not.
That's really interesting. So am I correct in assuming that some of the longer-term benefits of patient selection in this case, or drug selection for a given patient, would also be cost-effective? Not just better outcomes, which is kind of the obvious medical application, but also would it be cost-effectiveness because you wouldn't be prescribing the wrong drug to the wrong patient?
Yeah, in my practice, it's twofold. I remember in the beginning when we started doing this, and I talked to people in the payer industry, and they were concerned that all this is going to do is make you use more expensive drugs. And, you know, I think that hasn't borne out. In fact, there are many times I've taken people off of very expensive third-tier antidepressants, again, because they had failed so many other treatments, and actually put them back on a generic drug as an example of this. But if you think of the time frame of this, the number of patients that are hospitalized, whether that's for adverse drug events or for psychiatric admissions as an example of this, and also the comorbidity. So I have a lot of young patients who are being worked up for their irritable bowel syndrome and get CT scans and scopes and lots of other things, MRIs of their head because of headaches, et cetera. And really, their behavioral health issues are at the core of this. And so I think getting that treated early on, all that comorbidity and cost associated with workup of that, has the potential, and I'm not saying it always times, but it has the potential to dry some of that up and reduce costs as well.
No, I really appreciate your insights here. It's incredibly interesting. Do you have any final comments you want to share with your fellow physicians, your colleague physicians here?
I would just encourage people to be open-minded about this. I know that new technology is always difficult if it's not a machine. And, you know, if there's a new imaging machine, we do it right away. And I also think this doesn't fit right now into everybody's everyday practice. How do you order this test? It's a buccal swab. I know how to send somebody to Quest or LabCorp to get a blood test, but how do you do this? And really, it is very, very simple. It's very easy for patients. It's non-invasive. I think cost is no longer a factor in this. And I think if you really want to start seeing results, start in this population that we've talked about today. These young adolescent patients suffering from behavioral health issues where the sense of urgency here is really extreme, and you're going to see results in a large percentage of your population early on.
Thank you. That's incredibly useful. Just one final pragmatic question. Is variant interpretation a problem? If you get results back and you have a variation in a metabolism gene, how do you interpret those results? I mean, I suppose the ones that have been proven are easy and they come up with either being this will affect it or not. But you must come up with novel variants as well where it's unknown.
It's a really great question, Rachel. And one of the things that's encouraging here is when we're testing for this pharmacogenetic array, we're not doing a large swath of the exome where we're finding variants of unknown origin, or we have other genes that we don't know about. So we're looking for specific gene variants. And most of the time, and this is another caveat, good laboratories are associated with good interpretation software. And that means that the physician, and oftentimes the patient, is presented with a list of variants and a list of drugs. And sometimes those are listed in a form of red, yellow, green, meaning these are safe to give, these are drugs that you shouldn't give, and these are ones that may or may not have strong evidence or strong science, or it may have an intermediate effect. And I think that's really helpful. When I mention at the top of the podcast, let's at least pick drugs from a smaller hat. Going to that green list is what we're talking about.
Oh, fantastic. So I think that that's a really good good place to stop. And I appreciate your insights here. Really important topic and one that I think every family doctor is faced with. So thanks for your insights here.
Thank you, Rachel. It's been a pleasure.
Next, we're going to jump over to Professor Jennifer Brown from Harvard University, who's going to talk about chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL. So, great. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Brown. Could you please tell us a little bit about yourself and what your research interests are?
Sure. I'm director of the CLL Center and Institute Physician at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, as well as the Worthington and Margaret Collette Professor of Medicine at Harvard. And my interests really focus on a variety of aspects of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which is, everyone is probably aware, is a type of chronic blood cancer, a mature B-cell malignancy that patients can often live with for a long time without getting treated. But over the last 10 to 15 years, we've had a really remarkable advance in the targeted therapy landscape. And a lot of my research has involved the development of those targeted therapies. And right now, we're very interested in resistance to targeted therapies. I particularly focus on genomics of resistance. And we're also particularly interested in the heritability of CLL. It turns out it's a rather heritable cancer, but we don't understand the basis of that nearly as well as we do for other cancers like breast and colon.
Oh, well, that's incredibly interesting, and I didn't know that, actually, so I've learned something today. So tell me a little bit about resistance and how the genomics at this point, is that a useful surrogate to determine which patients might be at risk for a resistance?
At the moment, we're still using clinical progression for our decision-making, but we do understand quite a bit about mechanisms of resistance to BTK inhibitors in particular. The first generation and second generation drugs in that class bind to a particular cysteine residue, cysteine 481, covalently. And so as you might expect, the primary mechanism of resistance so far identified is mutation of that cysteine to another residue that can't bind the drugs covalently. And you can detect these mutations on average perhaps 8 to 10 months prior to clinical progression, but there are patients who can stay on the drugs for even several years after a low-level mutation develops. So we don't stop just based on the mutation. But it does appear that about 50 to 70% of patients who clinically progress carry a BTK mutation. One of the hottest new drugs now is a non-covalent BTK inhibitor called pirtobrutinib, which is a different type of class of drug. It actually works independently of that cysteine residue, and so it can bind in patients whose disease has already progressed on the first and second generation drugs. It's not yet approved for CLL. It received a first approval for mantle cell lymphoma in January, and we do expect it to be approved for CLL. But that will add another line of therapy of BTK inhibition, probably after the first and second generation inhibitors.
Exciting. And so you mentioned that the current landscape has changed significantly in the last few years. Can you discuss about where we are now and where are we heading towards beyond the novel BTKI inhibitor that you discussed?
So a first-line therapy currently is a choice between the continuous therapy with BTK inhibitors. And, you know, most of us recommend using a second-generation covalent inhibitor, so that would be acalabrutinib or zanabrutinib. Both have been proven better tolerated than ibrutinib in head-to-head trials, and the zanabrutinib trial actually also showed improved efficacy compared to ibrutinib. But there's also an option of time-limited therapy, which uses the BCL-2 inhibitor venetoclax with the anti-CD20 antibody obinutuzumab, and that's 1 year of therapy. Those actually have very similar 4-year progression-free survivals. The venetoclax obinutuzumab is only for 1 year and then you stop, whereas you stay on the BTK inhibitor. You know, where we're going in frontline therapy is toward combinations, potentially a BTK inhibitor and BCL2 inhibitor, plus minus the antibody. And so there are a lot of single arm trials or phase 2 trials of those combinations. We don't have head-to-head data yet comparing these options of the continuous BTK inhibitor versus the time-limited venetoclax with antibody versus the time-limited BTK inhibitor with BCL2 inhibitor. There is a trial that has completed accrual but not yet been reported, and there are obviously more clinical trials coming comparing the different time-limited options and then also at least a couple trials comparing the continuous therapy to the time-limited therapy. The hope, of course, is with the time-limited therapy that you might be able to repeat it again later and not have lost any of your effective classes of drugs. Whereas if you do the BTK inhibitor continuously first, the patients can stay on it for a very long time. But if they progress on drug, then they're no longer sensitive to that class.
Yeah, I see that. Okay, great. And so for the general physician, say a family doctor, what do they need to know about CLL? What are the things that you feel as an expert in this field should be recognized early?
Right. So one thing is to not panic when someone has a mildly elevated lymphocyte count. That's not an emergency. We're seeing people diagnosed earlier and earlier, and many of them end up very fearful, but that's really unnecessary. The most important things actually for general doctors with CLL patients in their care are to make sure they get an aggressive vaccination schedule. So live virus vaccines are not allowed, but patients need their flu vaccine every year. They need all the recommended COVID vaccines for immunocompromised people. Even if they're not treated, they're still considered immunocompromised. Once diagnosed, we give them Prevnar 20. And I still also give them Pneumovax at least 2 months after Prevnar 20. And we tend to repeat every 5 years on the pneumococcal vaccines. Generally, the more you dose people, the better their response, because they do have inhibited responses to vaccines. So that's one of the most important things. And the other most important thing is second cancer screening, because there is increased risk of other second cancers in people with CLL, and skin cancer risk, including melanoma, is actually greatly increased. And so we make sure everybody sees dermatology regularly, and then otherwise they should do all their regular age-appropriate cancer screening. One that also I think needs mentioning that is not necessarily well recognized as pap smears, actually. We see HPV reactivation in women who may have had it 30 years before. Because,
oh, really?
Yes, because the type of T-cell immunity that controls it is impaired by CLL. So,
oh, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, and that's why patients also have a higher risk of shingles.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. Interesting. Fascinating. So my next question was about the Congress that you're organizing, the IWCLL. Could you tell me a little bit about that and what you're trying to achieve with that?
Sure. It's the International Workshop on CLL. It's actually the 20th anniversary of the meeting, which happens every 2 years. It's organized by a core group of the IWCLL Executive Board, and it represents about 1,000 people who are very interested in CLL across the spectrum of activities, from clinical to research, getting together to talk about our research. So, you know, I think that's one of the unique things about our community, is that many of us do a lot of research, including laboratory research, as well as see patients. And so the Congress actually spans all of those activities. We have genomics and proteomics, updated therapy. We're going to be discussing how we define success in CLL going into the future. Is it okay if you have to stay on your drug indefinitely? Or do you need to get off the drug to be counted as having your best outcome? And that type of question.
I see.
Yeah. And so I think it will be a very exciting set of discussions. And we're also going to talk at the end about what our research agenda should be going forward. Now that we have all these great drugs, what are the top questions that we need to address? And some of them include some of the issues that I was mentioning, like our patients are still immunodeficient. Some of them need to get immune globulin every month. You know, how can we fix that? Our treatments don't fix it, actually. And so, you know, that's an ongoing problem that really affects quality of life for patients. And the second malignancy risk as well is also not reduced in the setting of treatment. It may even be increased. So we still have a lot of work to do, even though the treatments are highly effective now.
Right. And my last question has to do with the patient experience. What kind of obstacles do you think that patients experience with this disease?
One of them has to do with the immune compromise. You know, in the setting of the pandemic, it was very, very challenging for our patients because they were afraid to ever go out, even with a mask. And, you know, we're at risk for not responding to vaccines, especially patients on therapy. A number of the therapies do further reduce the response to vaccines. So there's that. And I think a lot of patients are only starting to come out of their shell a little bit now. And so that hangs over their head all the time. And that's actually also true of the period from diagnosis until needing treatment. And a quarter of patients may never need treatment. But it's sort of like the sword of Damocles hanging over your head. You don't know what is going to happen. And people tend to think every symptom that they may have is from the CLL. And my first rule of CLL is that in newly diagnosed people is that whatever you think is due to the CLL is not due to the CLL. And so there's this adjustment of kind of learning to live with it as a chronic disease, which is very challenging for people. And then when it comes to treatment, you know, these oral drugs are extremely expensive. And depending on where people live in the country and their quality of insurance, the costs can be prohibitive. Most of the companies do have assistance programs, but this is a worry for a lot of patients also.
I bet. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I think we just gained a lot of understanding. I certainly did. So appreciate your time and expertise here.
Sure.
Thanks for listening to Physicians Weekly.